dysfunctional Roy family once again battle for control in the final installment of Jesse Armstrong's genius HBO TV series Succession, which has become, at very least, a cultural touchstone. The show centres around the ultra-wealthy Roy family, who are in control of media empire Waystar Royco. Since its 2018 premiere, the dark, often comedic drama has mostly focused on the power struggle between patriarch Logan and his wannabe successor, son Kendall. Season 3 ended with a massive cliffhanger, especially when Matthew McFadyen's Tom Wamsgans threw his wife, Shiv, and her family under the bus by informing Brian Cox's Logan Roy of their scheme. It earned McFadyen an Emmy for his supporting actor role. With me in studio this evening, complete with a box of Kleenex from all the tears she's shedding, is Jen Gannon, who's been watching the highly anticipated first episode of the final season. They're very parsimonious with the episode, episodes on this one.
They're
Jen.
Keeping it under wraps, which, you know, in good reason. They want it to be as surprising as they can.
Yeah, and we do have 10 episodes in this in this final season. You were telling me just before we came to air. Right, this is the last season. Mm. Why has Jesse Armstrong made that decision, do you think?
I think, you know, he is a British writer and he used to work on The Thick of It. And I think he learned from that time with Armando Iannucci how to end something and how to, he understands that brevity is best. I think a lot of American shows were used to going on for so many seasons and elongated, stretching stories out. And I think there's a tendency, something with Succession, you want to have it as muscular as possible and leave your audience wanting more and not have any fat on this beast. End the show on a high. And I think, you know, you don't want the writing to become complacent. You don't want the audience to get bored. And I think that's what he really, really strives for. And I think with season 3, there was this, you know, criticism creeping into a show where, you know, critics and viewers used to adore Succession, but they came a little bit nonchalant about season 3.
Okay, well, before we get into season 4, just talk to me a little bit about a lot of media attention and discussion around the relationship between Brian Cox, who plays the big boss here, Logan Roy, and Jeremy Strong, who plays his son, Kendall. What's going on there?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of fans have picked up on that strange relationship where, you know, Brian Cox, as we know, is very down to earth, but he's also very outspoken, and he has had in interviews many a choice word to say about Jeremy Strong's ideas around acting. Jeremy Strong would say he is a method actor, whereas Brian Cox is not backwards about coming forwards to say that he thinks that method is a whole load of baloney and you're just there to do the lines and get in and out and get your money. And he just vehemently opposes that kind of, you know, idea about being an actor. And there has been so much gossip about that and about, you know, behind the scenes, is that pushing the show to a finale before really it should have reached a finale? Is that, you know, feeding into Jesse Armstrong wrapping things up in season 4? We don't know. And because, you know, I think it's great in a way because it's kind of echoing the show itself. The show is very ambiguous when it comes to, you know, the real feelings behind any of the characters. Yeah. So I think this is a very fitting ending in a way.
Yeah, well, in some ways, I have to say there's a side of me that thinks, isn't it interesting that they, that they have this kind of power dynamic at play between the two actors, which kind of really does echo much of the power play that's at hand.
I mean, Brian Cox doesn't realise he's being method, maybe.
So, just remind us of where we were at the end of season 3, because I watched the first episode today, and if you haven't watched seasons 1, 2 and 3, good luck.
Yeah, you're straight
in. You will not know where you are. It'll take you a while.
Yeah, with Succession, there's no hand-holding. It really is. They just expect you to be there from day one and understand the rubrics of the family and the dynamics completely. Mm. And when we left it in season 3, I mean, the children, Kendall, Shiv and Roman, they've been betrayed by both their parents. Like, not only, you know, have you the King Kong daddy himself, Logan, but also Caroline, their mother, who actually gave her shares to their father, Logan, which sealed the deal because it blocked the sale of, you know, Waystar Royco to the tech crackpot Luke Matson. So that's what they wanted to do. They wanted to block that sale, but then Logan got wind of it and Caroline sent the shares over and effectively, you know, burnt the Coliseum down with her children inside, which is something that Roman said in season 2. And that's the thing about Succession. It's so layered and it's so, the writing is so rich that they're always signposting you to different things that may or may not play out in different seasons.
Yeah, but method actor or no method actor, would you not know if you're a member of the Roy family not to trust any of your siblings,
exactly,
your parents, or in fact anybody that any of them associate with.
You can't even trust Tom. Shiv, you know, used Tom, her husband, as a doormat. He's effectively the Princess Diana of the Roy family, coming in as this outsider trying to make it in their world. And he turned on her. She assumed he was this cuckold, but turned on her and sided with her father instead of her. And that's one of those things where Succession does so well. You have this close up, very tight close up at the end of season 3 of Shiv's face, and it's, you know, distraught and disbelief that her husband did that to her.
Did what he did. Let's listen to a clip from early on in this first episode. They have a new venture. It's called The Hundred. So Shiv here, played by Sarah Snook, Roman, played by Kieran Culkin, and Kendall, played by Jeremy Strong, are all discussing this new business venture. As I say, I wouldn't trust a single one of them.
The Hundred is Substack meets Masterclass meets The Economist meets The New Yorker.
I feel like we said iconic and you guys are leaning ironic.
Hey, T.
Fucking don't patronize me. Hey.
The money is here.
Oh, shit.
And Rome, I think your security of being very weird with them. They seem stupid and probably racist.
Uh-huh. Well, you look tired and your face is giving me a headache.
Oh, thank you.
Where have you been, sis?
What do you mean? Hey.
Where have you been?
Traffic and a call. Business for this. It's a good contact.
Yeah, we're going to circle back and exactly all that stuff, and we'll talk to you soon. See you later.
So, traffic, huh?
Yeah, traffic. What?
Shivy, are you snaking?
We hear that you've been talking to the Jimenez transition team.
Well, no.
Oh, no?
No.
No? Okay, so it's lies that our friend told us? They're lying to us?
Well, I've talked to them, but it's because I'm helping them out, as you already know.
Okay, so you are talking.
No, I returned a call. They want to, you know, talk about talking.
Oh, they want to talk about talking.
If you're explaining, Shiv, you're losing. That's Sarah Snook there as Shiv, Kieran Culkin as Roman, and Jeremy Strong as Kendall, the Roy children from Succession. And Jen Gannon speaking to us about the final season this evening. And even as I listen to that, I do say to myself, this is just a variation on a theme that we've heard in with the Roy family. You don't know who to trust. You don't know what they're actually saying on a phone call and who they're actually talking to and how they might be shafting you, even though they're saying, I'm your best friend.
It's always 3D chess with them. And like on the chessboard, they're playing with hand grenades. And they really do this thing where we know that the three of them have to work together in this rebel alliance, this, you know, as Kendall is calling them, the new Gen Roys. But there's no sense of community, as you can hear there. There's this tang of paranoia that's still in the air and they're trying to figure out each other's motivations, and you know, they're second guessing each other and thinking who's going to be the first to crack and crawl over to the dark side to their daddy, or like Shiv, go back to politics. You know, there's all this potential for that alliance is very fragile, and it, you know, we have that gorgeous tennis match of insults that they always trade in Succession, but it opens up to the vulnerabilities that are in the Roy children and the temptations that are on offer outside of this very precarious alliance.
Yeah, because I mean, we must acknowledge that we are talking about very wealthy people here, for the most part, very wealthy white people in this series, who have such a sense of entitlement and who don't really have that many difficulties to deal. You know, we hear one character at one point talking about, well, I could be losing 15 or 16 million here, but I'd still be rich.
Exactly. And that's the greatest thing about Succession in that way is as well, they always do it with this such authenticity. I mean, they have someone like Derek Blasberg, who is this man about town who has written for Vanity Fair, but he also is very much in that society. So he will always be advising them on what looks real, what sounds real, what watches do these people wear, what trainers are they going to be throwing out and bringing in, and also how much money is too much money or not enough money. And he innately understands that, and to have someone there to do that in the background just really informs the writing all the time.
There is, you mentioned politics there, and there is a presidential election going on in the background here. How important is that? I know it's very hard for us to judge because we've only seen one episode, how much it's going to play into the later episodes.
It will. I mean, this season is going to revolve around three major unresolved issues from the last season. So the sale of Waystar Royco, a new acquisition, and this looming spectre of the presidency, because the presidency was a big match, like in season 3, for basically you know, Logan Roy is the kingmaker, and he is has such influence that he and power that he is making the presidency. Mm. And there was a whole episode given over in season three about how they ended up back in this very toxic Republican Mencken, and we saw how Shiv was completely upset because it goes against all her politics, and that is going to be this huge issue, I think.
Was
in
that
this season.
Any kind of a reflection of real life when that they had a toxic Republican? Have we something different in this one? Are we looking at critiquing a different American political?
I think so. It's actually a much deeper in. It's more about menaced men, male rights and that kind of thing, but also the deeply conservative held views about, you know, yeah, anti-abortion, etc. And that is really where Mencken stands. And but he's also, it's kind of like the Roys have met their match because he feels as insincere as they do. So he's a slippery, slippery individual.
Yeah, Conor is who we're going to hear from. Just explain who Conor, Greg and Willow are before we hear this clip.
Conor is the older son. He's the eldest of the Roy children, and he has sided with his father against his younger siblings, and he's going for the presidency as well. He's thrown his hat into the ring, as we've seen.
Good
and
man,
that's why he's sticking with his dad to get that money to launch him as a candidate.
Here he is explaining the money behind it all.
Just polling. And yeah, 10 days out. And
nice. What are you at now?
Solid. Still holding.
Yeah, 1%.
It's just the fear is in these last days, it could get squeezed.
Squeezed down from one? Because that's the lowest number.
No,
possible.
There's, you know, decimals. You know, they're saying that I could need to get aggressive in certain media markets because both sides are trying to squeeze my percent.
That's greedy when they have all the other percents.
I know. But then it gets awfully spendy to get aggressive.
Like how much?
Like another 100 mil.
100 million. Damn.
Wow. I mean, and so what would you get for that? I mean, could you win? Good Lord, no.
No. That won't move the needle, no. The hope is that would maintain my percent.
Okay, and for your percent, you get?
He gets a place in the conversation.
Which is great, because conversation's important to be inside of. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and a bit like Shiv, if you're explaining you're losing, if you're asking too many questions, Willow, you're asking them for a reason.
Willa wants to know that she is going to have money at the end of this, and that
she's engaged to Greg at this stage.
She's engaged to Connor, they're going to get married this season. So there is going to be, we love a succession wedding. We've had one before. We saw Shiv and Tom's wedding in season one, and it's always a deeply disturbing affair. So there's going to be another wedding, but Willa needs to be assured that she is going to have the money at the end of the day, and he's not frittering away his fortune on becoming a non-runner as a president.
Yeah. Of course she's marrying him for love.
Oh, of course, as everyone does in Succession.
Yeah, and Nicholas Braun playing
cousin
Greg. Who's cousin Greg there. I suppose, what tone did you pick up off the first? I did have that reservation, as I've said, Jen, that I kind of thought, well, first of all, there's no explainers here, but also I'm in the same world. So maybe Jesse Armstrong has the right idea here. Mm. Look, let's get out of this while we're a bit ahead.
I think there's only so many ways in which you can torture the same family over and over again. And like how, you know, this family can be put through that torment. And, you know, I think over time you're going to be, it's repeating the same trick. And at the end of the day, the show is called Succession. So there has to be a successor. And he knows where the story has to end. He wanted to end it in season one. He wanted it to be a one-off and then was convinced to keep going. So we can see he's always had the end in sight. And that's the way it has to be played out, I think. I do think that this season is quite melancholy, though, because you see at the start
that's
of
the
it...
the tone that you're fed very, off the first episode.
Because you see at the start of this new episode that Logan, yet again, he's celebrating a birthday. That's repeating from season one. He was celebrating his birthday then. And it's getting more and more like a being awake because his children aren't there. He's not happy. He says nothing tastes good.
I'd love to play a clip of Logan Roy. But I couldn't play any more than about 3 seconds.
Too sweary.
It's foul-mouthed. In fact, they're all foul-mouthed. But that's, I suppose, if you're watching it, you know that when you get involved. What do you think, Jen, is the bigger question? What has Succession done in terms of television drama? You know, has it moved it on in some new way? I mean, we have seen these kind of nasty people before, but what did Succession do that was different?
I think they were surprised about what a worldwide success it was and how it's everyone from critics to, you know, Instagram influencers have really taken this family to heart. And even though we know that not one of them has any, you know, redeemable characteristics whatsoever, they're all horrendous, we can still find something in them that we actually find enjoyable to watch enough. And I think that is because the writing itself, it has this gorgeous mix of comedy and drama, and is not afraid to push and push and push. And I think for an American audience, I think that's a very different thing. They've never, we've seen The White Lotus now, and that's probably its kind of closest heir in a way, because I think American TV, they always had to have that I love you dad, you always had to have the moral at the end of the tale, or, you know, just push the fact that these people are awful. But Succession kind of blurs those lines and it makes people more comfortable with these nasty, horrible people.
And if you had to come up with a successor to Succession, if there was going to be a spin-off, any of the family members really could have their own series, couldn't they?
They really could, but I don't know if that's that. What he wants to do with these characters, he said he is done with, and that's the way it's going to go.
Right.
I mean, I don't think we're going to expect, you know, I don't know, Roman Roy making it in the big city, or, you know, Kendall's saddest depresso boy hour. I don't think we're going to get that. I think what he's doing is right, and I think he's leaving it with the right note and leaving us wanting more. And I think that's what you should do with
and
a great show.
And you will be glued to the 10 episodes when you, or the remaining nine that you have to watch when you get a chance to
I'm
see them.
I'm going to miss my terrible, horrible family for the past 5 years. I mean, if anything, it's the most quotable show out there, I think, as well. And I think that's what people really will remember, the lines, and there's been so many of them. That and Kendall's rap, I think, will, you know,
we'll go down. All right.
People in TV history.
Look up Kendall's rap on YouTube. I'm sure they'll find it there. Thanks, Jen. I'm sure there will be something else to replace Succession in your TV watching. Jen Gannon speaking to us. To Succession season 4 begins on Monday on Sky Atlantic and Now TV. Is It Still Raining is a new exhibition of paintings from artist Sophia Campbell. It's now on at the Irish Architectural Archive in Dublin, courtesy of the Oliver Sears Gallery. Sea swimming and a lockdown walk provide the starting points in this debut solo show, which explores the relationship between humans, water and flowers. Sophia Campbell joins me now on the line. And as we're speaking with Sophia, we're going to tweet some of the images from the exhibition at RTE Arena, if you want to see those images as we are tweeting them. And I'll begin with a painting called Last Bloom, which we'll tweet now on at RTE Arena. Welcome to the programme, first of all, Sophia. This is one of the larger paintings, this Last Bloom that I've just tweeted. Larger paintings in the exhibition. Maybe you could describe what we're looking at. It's a very familiar scene in many ways, this lamppost.
Yeah, so it's one of the larger paintings in the exhibition. The central image is a lamppost, and it's wrapped from top to bottom with flowers in front of like a yellow skyline.
And these bundles of flowers, it often put somewhere where there's been a car accident or something like that. And we also see on the lamppost just a hint of a face, which could be the person who unfortunately lost their lives in this spot, or it could be a missing persons type of situation. I suppose there's a lot of untold story in a lamppost like this.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, this is, although the painting and the paintings in general tend to not really represent a specific place, this was like a time where obviously I was going on a lot of walks, and it's a lamppost that's quite near to where I live. And, you know, there were certain days where I'd walk past and it would be, you know, completely wrapped with all these beautiful flowers, and then other days it would be completely empty. But, you know, the picture of the person remains on the lamppost no matter what. But, yeah, I guess, you know, I try to keep it kind of not necessarily anonymous, but, you know, it's a symbol for obviously a lot of things, you know. But in this case, this was what I was walking past frequently.
Yeah, on a regular basis. And in fact, there are other paintings that echo Last Bloom. They could even possibly be very fine details from Last Bloom, or there could be other lampposts in different parts of not just Belfast. But let's face it, these type of memorials effectively are all over this country, all over this island, all over the world, in fact.
Yeah, that's right. So like you said, the other paintings in the exhibition are kind of similar to this one in terms of the flowers, but I guess this painting is kind of the central image to the rest of the flower paintings, and they all kind of stem from one image, or at least from this one same post, this lamppost, but, you know, at different times, like I mentioned before, whether it was completely covered in flowers or, you know, at other times where it was empty and just had kind of chain wrapping around it.
Let us tweet a further image at this point, Sophia. And this is the chain breaks oil. Again, not quite as large as Last Bloom, but a reasonably large painting. We have an upended or an upside down bunch of essentially tulips, it looks like here. And then there's this chain, a broken chain, which isn't quite holding them up. They're kind of hanging there by some kind of suspension magic. Explain to me some of the ideas that you were having here and how this is a development on from the last bloom that we spoke about earlier there.
Yeah, so in this painting, the kind of the upside down flowers, this was obviously a way that some of the flowers were presented onto the lampposts. And I think I just kind of found that visually like quite interesting, and especially like the chain, which kind of became a recurring motif across a lot of the paintings. There was something about the contrast between, you know, the delicacy of these flowers and the kind of the harshness of these chains that were being used to keep them attached. I just kind of, you know, in like a visual sense as well, I just thought that was quite interesting, and it was something I kind of wanted to depict in this painting.
Yeah, and to what extent, Sophia, are, you know, the lamppost itself, the first one that we spoke about, looks like, to a certain extent, it's a realistic image of that lamppost that you walked past all the time. To what extent then, in paintings like The Chain Breaks Oil, were they flights of the imagination as opposed to realizations of something you'd actually seen?
Yeah, I mean, I guess, like, when I'm painting in the studio, you know, it all does central around an image that I'm working from, but at certain points, you know, I guess like you have to let a painting be a painting, and you make decisions based on the surface and based on, you know, on the colors and kind of what I'm, you know, maybe feeling in that moment. It kind of can become a separate thing where, you know, it's about the painting, if that makes sense. Like physical act of painting, you know.
Yeah, it's not a painting of something. It is a painting, full stop, and that's its statement. Your grandmother was a very important creative role in your family. Your mother, Jackie Crooks, is a painter and printmaker, and you studied fine art yourself at the University of Ulster. You graduated in 2019. But it sounds, before that formal education, as if there was a lot going on at home in terms of your grandmother and your mother in terms of art, learning art, if you like.
Yeah, I guess obviously growing up, it was a large part of my life, with my mum being an artist. It was obviously something that I was constantly doing and constantly being encouraged to do. And I think as well, like growing up with my mum being an artist and being an art teacher, it definitely encouraged me to pursue that as well. So that was obviously a great help. And, you know, being kind of introduced to the art scene and the art world from a young age. And yes, as well with my granny. So actually the painting, The Chain Breaks, comes from one of her poems, which is called Broken Chain. But the last two lines read, "I call your name, the chain breaks." And obviously with the kind of imagery of the chains in these paintings and that being a recurring motif, I guess that poem kind of was at the back of my mind at that time, you know, like the connection with the chain. So it just kind of felt right to sort of title it after my granny's poem.
Absolutely. Flowers are very important, a key image in the exhibition. Water is another equally important idea that's going on within the exhibition as well. I'm going to tweet another image now, Sophia. Head Above. Yep. Head Above is the title of this one, at RTE Arena, if you want to see things here. Again, maybe you describe this for us, first of all, Sophia.
Yeah, so in this painting, you see a head and a hand emerge from water at the bottom of the canvas. And very subtly, you kind of see a large wing that sweeps across the top half.
Yeah, because I wondered what that image behind was. To me, there was a kind of a sense of a big mountain there in behind. But this is a kind of an abstract imagined painting as well.
I guess so, yeah. The actual, at the very top of the painting, kind of that's above the wing, it's sort of like a shape of an umbrella, which kind of comes from that water imagery. But that's all right.
Kind of... Well, listen, I hope that the exhibition does very well for you, and that we'll see you in person down at this neck of the woods at some point along the way. In the meantime, thanks for being with us this evening, Sophia. Sophia Campbell there. And Sophia's exhibition is called Is It Still Raining? It's at the Irish Architectural Archive in Dublin. It's there until the 5th of April, and you'll find out full details on oliversearsgallery.com. You know, not everybody's a fan of Succession, and not everybody's looking forward to season four. Here's one of the texts that came in. Succession is one of the most overrated, repetitive and boring series I have ever watched. I've seen every episode and it never moves on. I suggest people watch the 3-part documentary on the Murdochs, which RTE showed a few years ago. Really interesting and a great watch, says that texter. Now I wonder how people will feel about our 3 albums tonight, because we have 3 big albums. First up, a band very much at the forefront of the folk and traditional Irish music revival of the last decade. The last album from Lancome, The Livelong Day, received huge acclaim. Is that going to be the case with their 3rd studio album, which arrives today? It's called False Lancome. Next up, another huge critical favourite, Depeche Mode. 43 years ago, they were formed in Basildon in England. Their 15th album arrives today, following the death, of course, last year of their founding member, Andy Fletcher. Dave Gahan and Martin Gore are the driving duo now behind Depeche Mode 2023. The new album is called, suitably enough, Memento Mori. And finally, American singer Elizabeth Grant, known to you and me, I think, as Lana Del Rey, winner of 6 Grammy Awards, a Golden Globe and 2 Brit Awards, amongst many other accolades. More adventurous in her musical output of recent years, they say. Her 9th album is the one we will be talking about later on, with the intriguing and very long title of Did You Know That There's a Tunnel Under the Ocean Boulevard? Is there a question mark? I don't think there is. Anyway, Andrea Clary and Paul McLoone have been listening. They're with me in studio now. Let's start at home with Lancome and the opening track and current single from the album. The track is called Go Dig My Grave.
Go dig my grave, both wide and deep. Place a marble stone at my head and feet. That railroad boy that I loved so well, he courted me.
There we go. That's just 2 minutes, in fact, of the opening track. Go Dig My Grave from the new Lancome's album, which is called False Lancome, and that opening track is 8 minutes and 42 seconds long. I suppose Andrea Cleary and Tom McLoone, Tom McLoone, how you doing, Tom? How's your brother Paul coming in later on? Paul McLoone,
he's always late.
Paul McLoone are with me in studio this evening. That's classic Lancome, really, the way the album opens, Andrea. Just the voice of Ray D. Pete there, and it builds. We hear that chord that comes in, I think it's on a dulcimer of some kind, and it builds over the 8 minutes and 42 seconds into total, not cacophony isn't the right word, but the big sound by the end of it.
Yeah, it's something that kind of approaches chaos but never really passes over into it. And it's that sparseness, it's that patience, and it's that patience that they sort of command of you, the listener, as well. I mean, I'd be happy to do away with this entire segment and just let everybody listen to the 8 minutes of that song, because it is truly...
Thanks for coming in and goodbye.
like the Wild Rover on the Live Long Day, it is a song that rewards your attention and it commands it, and they make the kind of music that you just can't turn away from. They're incredible.
Yeah, I found myself on several occasions today listening to the tracks, and if you turned away to do something, you'd say, no, you now have to go back to the beginning of that track, because you can't just come in the middle of it and think you can pick up, because it really does. These are trips that demand input from the listener.
Absolutely.
Each song.
I think each track, and that opening track is such a bold thing as well. They start something so sparsely and so quietly and, as you say, command the attention of the listener. Not even ask for it, just demand it. And it really does build this kind of apocalyptic almost kind of thing. I did need a bit of a break. I mean, I think the sequence of the album is brilliant as well, because they do kind of take you on. Each track is its own journey, but also the album as a whole, I think, is brilliantly sequenced. I think that the kind of lulls, there are literally little interludes that kind of give you a bit of a breather.
Yeah, they have a little thing called a fugue every three or four tracks. You could listen to a section of the album and stop.
And I think that's just brilliant. And it's great to see a band or an artist, and there are many who still do, but still valuing that idea of 40 minutes or an hour. And this is, you know, from start to finish, this is your journey. You know, I think that's great. And they do it brilliantly.
Although, did I note a little bit of compromise, perhaps, on the part of Lancome on this new album, Andrea? It came in the second track, Clear Away in the Morning. I thought, that's as poppy as Lancome are ever going to get. Yeah. It's still 7 minutes long, but it kind of, I thought, that's easy. That's maybe a more kind of international feel to it than a very strong Irish traditional feel to it. And it's there in a track later on as well, Netta Perseus, I think.
Beautiful track.
And do you think there's a bit of compromise coming on?
I'm not sure if it's a compromise. It's maybe a bit more of accessibility. Like when we spoke about the Live Long Day, and I mean everybody spoke about the Live Long Day. It was such an incredible time. Us all kind of wondering what this new sound means, and a lot of that sound was the drone, was the very kind of dark and dirgy elements to their version, if you like, of folk music. Here, that lets up a little bit. There's a bit, kind of, for want of a better term, softer side to Lancome that we see here. We see it in Netta Perseus. We hear it in Lorda Bourne, Mary Flynn as well, which is an incredible
nine-minute
ballad that is like that first track. Just again, like if you turn away, you'll miss half the story.
You'll miss Act 3. Let's listen to a little bit of Netta Perseus, which I think is possibly the shortest track on the album, apart from the little fugues, which are a minute long. Those in between moments. This one. 5 minute song, Netta Perseus. Flavour there of Netta Perseus from False Lancome, the new album from Lancome. And in fact, that grows out of the fugue number two is just in front of it, and it really leads you into that track. So are we in the same territory as the Live Long Day? Are we in as good a place, or are we in a better place? What do you think of this album overall, Paul?
I think it's a big step forward, to be honest, creatively. I think, as we were just sort of touching on a moment ago, I think there's a lot of light and shade in there. I think the instrumentation and the production are really, really interesting. There's a track, the name of it escapes me now, but there's a track where it's what appears to be not dissimilar to that one, but the instrumentation is sort of what you might call traditional or standard, but there are things happening around the edges, these kind of almost Brian Eno-ish sort of reverberations.
Is either the New York
Master Crowley's?
It could be that one, yeah.
I mean, they all have their great moments. Yeah.
But and the instrumentation, I think, is really intriguing on this record. I mean, that opening track that we heard a few minutes ago as well, thank you for naming the instrument. It's a dulcimer then, but it's so unusual the way it's used, and it kind of comes in. And you're not expecting it, and it's almost discordant, and it shouldn't work, but it does. They've obviously put a lot of thought into what happens when, and not just this is a guitar ballad, or this there's more going on, there's more detail, there's a richness to it.
Stars from you, Paul?
Oh, 4.5.
4.5. And in the interests of safety, I think it's a dulcimer. Yeah, okay. Pretty certain it's a dulcimer. Before Lancome
answers on a text message, folks.
If you can tell us, do text. But I think it is a dulcimer. And what are you saying overall on this one, Andrea?
Yeah, I think that there's something about this album and the last album, I think nearly equally, and it's that particular something that brilliant albums have. And you can't put your finger on it. It's a particular timbre. It's their ability to evoke something kind of ancient and primal while also being contemporary and pushing their genre forward, I think they're the very, very best example of what this genre can be. And so my first of the year on Arena, this is 5 stars for me. Five out of five.
5 stars from you. 4.5 and 5 for Lancome and False. Lancome, nothing false about it at all. I'm not sure about the name. I'm not sure where they have that.
No, it's puzzled me as well.
It's from an old traveler ballad, I believe. And that's where they get their name, Lancome, from.
Well, no, that's where Lancome comes from, but the False, I'm wondering, maybe that's part of the
story. Yeah.
Let us move on to Depeche Mode, and even the title of this album says it for us. Memento Mori, it translates, I suppose, a remembrance of death, or remember you must die, is effectively what it's saying here. Obviously a reference to the founding member Andy Fletcher, who died last year. Let's listen to a track called Ghosts Again. Just beautiful the way that Luke and speaking to the friend and saying, we know we'll be ghosts again. That's Depeche Mode, the new album, Memento Mori. And Paul, impossible not to. Andy Fletcher is actually all over this album. It's a real expression of missing a friend and the joy that the friendship had and the sorrow at his passing.
Absolutely. But surprisingly, or at least it surprised me, it's framed in probably their most accessibly pop record that they've done, I think, maybe since the turn of the 90s, you know. I mean, back at that, when they were huge, well, they still are, but, you know, that huge breakthrough they had with what was it called, Violator. And it's kind of radio friendly is the horrible term that people might use, but it was surprisingly upbeat. It kind of wrong-foots you, the album. It starts with this very kind of doomcast sort of industrial sort of vibe, the sort of thing that they've been doing over the recent run of records. And you sort of think, okay, that's fine, here we go again. And then it just totally changes mood. And they go into this kind of parade of songs that are just really sort of poppy, surprisingly kind of melodic and poppy. And in fact, it reminded me of the Vince Clarke era, some of it, really. And I mean that as a compliment. Their original songwriter, back when they were first these fresh-faced, literally these fresh-faced youths on Top of the Pops, they were still in their late teens, I think. And he was the main songwriter back then, and it was very poppy. It's not quite as obviously bright and cheerful as that, given the backdrop to what we're talking about here. But it's a very, very commercial record, to use another horrible word.
Yeah, 43 years ago, was that when they were actually started up, Andrea? And yet somehow, even as you listen to that track, it's a hark back in some ways. It's an old-fashioned style to it. But they seem to have managed to keep themselves pretty relevant. How have they done that, do you think?
I think there's something to be said for not taking too many risks throughout your career up until this point, in order to keep up with the Joneses in terms of the sound of pop music. I mean, Depeche Mode, it's been pointed out elsewhere in the Guardian and Pitchfork, both in their reviews pointed out that Depeche Mode are a band who have never really embarrassed themselves, which I find very, very interesting. And I'm always very, very interested to hear from bands who are this late into their career. This is their 15th album. And listening to this record, it was a grower for me, I'll say that. And I was absolutely wrong-footed by that first song. When I put it on, I thought, oh no, this is going to be just
a dirge.
Oh, it's going to be a nightmare. But it really grew on me, and the kind of the depth of it and the maturity with which they write about their friend's death, you know, and if you're in a band with someone, it's not your friend, it's your brother, it's your family member, you know.
And he was relatively young at 60.
Really, 60 years of age. And just that sort of, it's kind of impossible to write about that in this way without those decades and decades of having spent this time together. And I feel like you feel that time, and you feel it in the music, and the kinds of creative decisions that they're making feel a bit like homage. I think it's a really lovely piece.
Stars from you on it, Andrea.
Like I said, it was revealed at more listens. I found it very reflective, and I think that they are still managing to be who they are, but with more kind of wisdom and reflection. So it's 3.5 for me.
3.5 for me. Yeah. What are you saying, Paul?
Their time has come again. Their time is at hand again, I reckon. And I would give that 4.5. Once again, I'm not giving everything 4.5 tonight. I hasten to that. But right. Yeah, just by coincidence, 4.5. Yeah, and it's amazing that sound. I think what they've embraced is the fact that they have influenced so much of what is current and recent as well. And they've just taken that on board and gone, you know what, we used to be great at these tunes. Let's just do these tunes. And what better a tribute to Fletch, who interestingly as well was often cited as the kind of glue that held the two poles of the band, Martin Gore and Dave Gahan. I think there's a bit of creative tension between those two, or at least there has been in the past. And Fletch was kind of cast as the diplomat between the two. Glue, so it's brilliant and revelatory to see them clearly so harmonious on this record.
They, I think they've both said that they're much closer now, that his death has brought them much closer to you. So very solid 4.5 and 3.5 respectively there from Paul and Andrea for Depeche Mode and Memento Mori. Let's move on to our final album, Lana Del Rey. Did you know that there's a tunnel under Ocean Boulevard? I did not, Lana. Let us listen to a track. Let's go for Paris, Texas. Texas, the title of that track from Lana Del Rey. And did you know that there's a tunnel under Ocean Boulevard? And you were saying, even as we were listening to that, Andrea, that there's nothing like a good waltz.
There's nothing like a good waltz.
Nothing like a good waltz.
I love a waltz.
And that is a beautiful waltz from Lana Del Rey on that. What's she doing here on this album?
That's a good question. I mean, this album is very much, I think, again, quite reflective. There's moments in the album where she's kind of reinterpolating herself. She's looking back at things like how the music industry has treated her thus far. The song A&W, which is an astonishing track.
That's another one. It's eight or nine minutes.
She's a lot to say on it. She certainly does. And that, you know, it addresses misogyny and the kinds of things that she's had to kind of... Because, I mean, how she's been treated and how her image has been treated and kind of the lack of seriousness with which she's been treated up until, I'd argue, 2019 when she put out Norman Rockwell.
Thank you for calling it Norman
Rockwell. You're very welcome.
Norman effing Rockwell.
Norman
is the title
effing
of
Rockwell.
The,
So this album, it's not one that has, I mean, so far in my own listening, a very kind of cohesive idea or message. But the message or the idea or the claim could be just straightforward self-examination, which is what she is brilliant at. You know,
Paul McLuhan. Who is your starter for 10? Who is the king of hipster fraudulence?
Oh, that would be Father John Misty.
Stop it.
Who appears on the track, Let In The Light. Let The Light In.
Dreadful.
Obviously
Father
didn't
John.
Happen for you. No light came in at all, did it?
You know what? I have liked a lot of Lana Del Rey's work in the past. I really have. And I really love that tune. I'm glad you started with that.
That's a lovely tune.
And it's by far my favourite thing on what for me is an otherwise quite enervating experience as a record. I just couldn't get a handle on it. It just seemed to drift past. And I know lyrically there's a lot going on there, but just musically for me, it just didn't have enough of a hook. It just seemed to be one kind of piano ballad after another. No, it's not exclusively that. There are tracks that aren't that. But, you know, for the most part, it just all drifted into one sort of thing that just went over my head.
The case for the defence?
I mean, I will say, first of all, I think Father John Misty is a genius.
Oh, he's a great drummer.
But I think that Father John Misty, and this is the third time that they've collaborated, I think him and Lana are kindred spirits in a way, in that I think they're both often misunderstood and that they're both quite quietly experimental in what they do. But I mean, I think the case for the defence is that I think she's been making for the past, what are we now, 20, like 4 years, the most experimental and freed music of her career. I think that she's creating with abandon. She's throwing out convention. Oh, right. And it's not always this kind of big hammer down idea. Sometimes you can just be kind of quietly experimental, and I think that's what's happening here. Stars for me, I'll stick with it. 4 stars for me.
4 stars from you. Oh, Paul McLean.
I was digging a tunnel by the time it was.
Go on.
2 from me. I'm not alone for the ride on this one. I'm sorry. I respect her. I think she's great. She's very talented, but not this one. No, thanks.
Send your brother Tom in the next night. Yes, he'd probably like it much more. There we have it. Lana Del Rey, 2 and 4 respectively. Did you know that there's a tunnel under Ocean Boulevard, the title of the album? Memento Mori, Depeche Mode was the previous one, and the one that both Andrea and Paul were in total accord over, False Lancome from Lancome. And that is our lot for this week here on Arena. Paula Shields and Leah Murphy researched. Stephen Higgins was the broadcast coordinator. Aisling Grufferty was on sound this evening. And the programme was produced by Sinead Egan. I'll be back with you Monday, 7 o'clock here on RT Radio 1. Join me on Lyric, RT Lyric FM, Sean Roxon, Sunday 1 to 4 in the afternoon. I'd love to have your company there for some beautiful music over those 3 hours.